Horace, we've discussed the concept of over-serving from time to time. And I read recently with interest a Gartner report on connected vehicles. Gartner's presence in this space indicated to me that some of their clients are obviously interested in adding technology to cars. One might think of Qualcomm, Intel, Google, Apple, Microsoft, and the cellular operators. I believe Verizon has a deal with Audi and others. So were we wrong about the car being an accessory to the smartphone, or is Gartner helping the industry overserve?
So what is Gartner saying again?
Well, they're saying that, here's a quote, they said that connected cars are poised to play a pivotal role in the Internet of Things. So there's a, you know, there's the latest term du jour, I guess. And the firm predicted that 4.9 billion connected things will be deployed in 2015, and that cars in the next 5 years will be a significant part of that.
Well, you know, this is the problem with this strategy, though, is that this only is viable if the car remains an integrated product, meaning that if the module that is providing connectivity, including software, the software that's involved, including the network technologies that are involved, are controlled by the car maker.
Right.
If the car maker bundles that stuff, puts it in the car 5 years before it goes on the production line, as they normally do, and then deploys it through the manufacturing process it has and the distribution process it has, which is the dealer network, and then the service of it goes through the same dealer network, and then it remains on the road for 10 years or whatever is the normal lifetime of that vehicle, then you're looking at a 15 to 20-year cycle for what, 3G?
Right.
2G? 1G? What G are we on here? Right. That's the problem if you want to say that this is a connected product. Connected with what? What we're seeing, just give you the most avant-garde car companies, Tesla, and they have an integrated computer / diagnostics / operating system / connectivity in the car, and it is indeed very, very spiffy. Elon Musk just announced that through a firmware upgrade over the air pushed to the car, they're going to get an acceleration of 0.1 second faster in their cars.
Right.
It's a fantastic thing. It's unbelievable. But it's 1999 in terms of what computers can do, right?
Right.
So it's got that nice, aroma. That software has an aroma of the 1990s. And those cars are running on the 3G network. You want LTE? Forget about it. I mean, it's not going to happen on a Tesla because, I mean, maybe they have a way of going into the shop with it and getting all those modules replaced, but it's probably going to be $1,200 or something like that, knowing how much they charge for stuff. So the problem is, yes, fine, they could do all those things. Technically, there's no reason not to do those things. The problem is that the cycle time of improvement in computers is faster than the cycle time of improvements in networks, and is faster than the cycle time of improvements in car design, and which itself is faster than the cycle time of improvements in production systems. So you have four different clock cycles running, each one probably twice as fast as the next. So how can you cope with a 15-year cycle of automotive production with 15-month cycle for software upgrades? I would say even less. I mean, how fast does iOS get updated? How mm-hmm. fast does Android get updated? How fast does Windows get updated? These are on 12-week cycles, and 12-month cycles at average, I would say. And that's what does that mean? That means that they have to architect the vehicle to be competitive, to be viable as a strategy, right? I mean, they can do it once and it's not viable. But to be viable as a long-term strategy, they have to be modular, meaning that, yes, you can update your operating system in the car. You can update, in fact, the hardware that runs that operating system. You can update this communication hardware, because you're going to see new generation networks coming within the lifetime of your car.
Sure, maybe two or three.
I mean, give you another example. Here's what bugs me. You know, I have an E500 Mercedes, and it's a great little car, or a great big car.
V8, right?
Yeah, it's got a V8 engine, something of a dinosaur almost, these days. V8s are going to disappear, yes. And I'm happy to have one of the last. But the point is that it has a SOS feature in it, right? This is one of these things where you push a button and it calls up to a satellite.
Right.
Well, it's similar to OnStar. Right. I don't know if they have their own or something riding on top of it as some version of it. But the thing is that the 800 number that it calls when it's activated is no longer in use. That 800 number just was yanked.
Right.
It was Mercedes lost the number.
Right.
And they, you know,
time to trade the Mercedes, Horace. You're too old.
Let me get to the punchline. It's only a 10-year-old car.
Right.
Okay. And that's, to me, nowhere near midlife on that vehicle. I mean, I keep my cars for 20 years at least. But this in particular, I bought it used, a 10-year-old car. And here's the thing, that when you turn on the engine, a little warning comes up. It says SOS system failure or something like that. And it, you know, I went to the mechanic and I said, "Can you just fix that, reset it?" He said, "No, we can't change it because the phone number it's dialing is no longer valid. It cannot, you cannot handshake, and that firmware cannot be changed in the car ever. This number cannot be reprogrammed." Somehow, within their wisdom, Mercedes-Benz, with billions of dollars in R&D budget, could not engineer the car so that in the case that the phone number that it calls whenever in an emergency, never mind the fact that the service doesn't work. I don't even care that the service doesn't work. What I care about is that annoying message that comes up every
blinking,
time I start the car.
Right.
It's a 10-year-old car, and in that sense, its software has been obsoleted. It cannot be updated. I have another car. I have a Porsche, you know, and this is a Porsche from 2006. So it's newer even, right? It's only 8 years old. And this is a Cayman. And it does not have ability to support, you know, auxiliary input as a line
audio,
in for audio.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the software for the map systems, the software for the unit that is controlling the you know the all the entertainment and all that other stuff cannot ever be upgraded. So forget about putting an app, you know, CarPlay or whatever Google's thing is. It that software is vintage 2005, right? It's of that vintage. It's got that nice patina to it, right? And you know everybody likes software with a nice layer of oxidation on top.
Exactly.
But that's exactly what we're looking at. So it's unless they open up the car to allow these modules to be replaceable, and if in so doing, they have to rethink their entire culture. They have to rethink the entire way they build and organize cars, because right now they're vertically integrated. We talked about this. They cannot. You cannot order a Ford with a Chevy engine. You cannot order, you know, a gas car and say, "Well, forget about the gas. Give me a diesel," or you know, and
swap
later
it
on,
out, right?
You know. Make sure it's upgradable to electric when that comes around. Forget about it. These parts of the car are fully integrated 5 years before it goes into production. And this is why, because of cycle time issues, the cycle time of components is much more rapidly advancing than the cycle time of the engine or the chassis or the regulations that govern it. And so this is why I wonder what Gartner is thinking here. What kind of vision do they have? Automakers like Audi saying that $60,000 or something of a car's value is in its electronics? That's just because they're really inefficient at writing code, right? It's you know, I could go on, but these are just symptoms of an underlying problem. This is the problem with the industry is that it's non-modular, and it's non-modular even though it's over 130 years old as an industry. And most industries, like in the phone business, we expect things to modularize in 3 years. They you know, forget about that. In the auto industry, it hasn't happened. And it's a mystery. In fact, the core mystery of this whole show is why it doesn't happen. Why some industries change and some industries don't. Why do some industries have 80-year-old replacement cycles in terms of core architecture and core ways of doing business, core business models, and other industries have 8-month cycles. I mean, it's just crazy. This is why I you know, whenever we have this proposal that yes, they will, and in fact, it's natural, and we've been saying that it's natural that the car be a smart part of our lives, right? It should be infused connected with intelligence. Sorry.
Yes,
connected. You wanted to say something.
Oh, sure. Well, I think the other thing that this Gartner report points out that I wanted to dive in further, because it kind of gets to our brand discussion recently. You know, this guy at Gartner said, well, digital consumption and creation within automobiles will get a boost, and therefore graphics accelerators, app processors, and human-machine interface technology will see increased demand. So I'm thinking, well, how is this happening? And my guess is, again, this is a pure guess, is that there are meetings going on, and they're looking at revenue models, right? I suspect the cell companies are involved, and they're looking at ways to monetize the time in the car. We've talked about that, shopping or whatever it is. And I think, again, you know, is this an example of over-serving where these companies, you know, they just throw the brand out the window and they keep looking at financialization? You know, the money is the thing driving the game. Therefore, when you buy your Porsche, your Mercedes, your Audi, your Chevy, whatever it is, your Toyota, you can now expect a $30 a month bill or $50 a month for entertainment, for connectivity. And by the way, it's part of the car,
it's
right?
It's just not going to happen. I mean, people are smart enough now to see right through that. So they can dream all they want. The fact is that people are much smarter about how they pay for communications, how they pay for entertainment, and how they pay for services that go through a phone. In fact, they probably don't pay anything at all. It's seen as something that's monetized through different ways, advertising, etc. And so that model's been established a long time ago. No one's paying. So they're not even paying for music anymore, which used to be something you could rely on. But the thing was that let me step back a moment and address that question of overservice. I mean, when you talk about overservice, you have to define what is the thing that people buy, because you want to measure over or under a particular point of quality, let's say, or a point of performance. And so when you say a car is over-serving, you have to define the dimension. So you can say over-serving on the dimension of horsepower. That would make sense, because cars are you know, even horsepower is actually a proxy for, let's say, acceleration or speed. And so if you wanted to say that a car is over-serving in terms of horsepower, you're essentially saying that its car is too fast or it has power beyond what can be absorbed. And certainly a car over even 150 horsepower is probably over-serving, you know, in 99% of cases. And maybe people are willing to pay extra for the option to get beyond that, and there's a certain cachet with power, et cetera, et cetera. So I won't get into that. But the question is, overall, is the automobile itself being hired for a few, let's say, 5 dimensions? And on which of those is it over and which is it underserving? I mean, one thing might be, you know, capacity of carrying a certain number of people. That's one dimension. So you could say, well, a car with 10 passenger seats is over-serving, because most people don't want to have to, you know, drive a bus all the time, even if they might sometime want to put 10 people in it. You know, it's unlikely. I have, again, let's go back to the wagon I have, which is actually has seating for 7 people if I wanted it to. The in the trunk or the back part of the wagon, it has 2 extra seats.
Classic
that pop
wagon,
up.
Yes.
Yeah, classic, you know, almost never seen again since, you know, in American cars, since the minivan, we've seen this kind of seating capacity. I think wagons in themselves have become extremely rare. We were driving the other day, and I challenged my son as we were driving, you know, point out wagons as we go by. So we could have this game, who can spot another wagon? We're driving in a wagon, 20 miles or so journey, spot another wagon. That was the game we played. And it was kind of hard. You know, the closer we got to Cambridge, the more we found that we could see them. But they were mostly Subarus or Audis and a handful maybe of Mercedes. And those are all non-US brands. Right. I don't know if there's outside of a Chrysler model, maybe a 300, something like that, that there are any wagons available. But I digress. The point is that seating capacity is one dimension that Americans probably have said, you know, seven is too much. We you know, if we're going to have seven seats, actually the SUV, which supposedly replaced the wagon, has less seating capacity, has less space
generally,
inside.
Yes, exactly.
Generally, they're quite cramped.
Yes.
And more uncomfortable, I would say, as well. And they
less efficient, right.
Less efficient, poor performance, and tend to crash more in snowstorms. But that's again, beside the point. The thing is that people chose and said, don't give me more seats. Give me instead something else I can waste my money on. So the thing is that when you say, okay, so what are cars for then? And you say, oh, well, their transportation, and we ask, are they over-serving on transportation? And actually, no. The problem is, if I were to say what's missing out of the transportation solution, it's that we have too much congestion. I really want to get from point A to point B. If my car could somehow avoid congestion, cut through traffic, that would, you know, that's luxury. I'll take that over tail fins any day. So the thing is that the industry is not solving that problem. They're solving other problems that people don't necessarily want fixed, and that's where the, you know, this is where they're deeply underserving on problems that need solving, and overserving on things that are irrelevant. And one of those things that is, you know, is they're probably overserving on is, you know, these gadgets in the car that are superfluous.
Quickly obsolete, right? Or yeah, already and obsolete.
Someone put together sort of a montage of dashboard displays, dashboard and center console displays that was trying to show what is the visual design of automotive controls. And, you know, you just go to a car show or one of these, you know, launching car events, Los Angeles, Detroit, Geneva, whatever, Paris. You go just photograph the interiors and you just be gobsmacked about how horrible they are whenever seen through the lens of a good computer user interface or user experience design. And so what they do is they just keep pushing more and more clutter into this this system, and more buttons looking like a, you know, like an hi-fi stereo from the 1980s.
Radio cassettes, right?
You know, that was fashionable. I remember once when I was in college, I had a friend of mine who bought a new VCR, which, you know, he added to his collection of components that you would have back in the day. You know, you'd have an amplifier, you'd have a cassette deck, you'd have a record player, a CD player, and possibly some things with the VCR,
sure,
and a DVD player. Components, they were all stacked up.
Right.
And the most impressive thing you could show off in that stack would be just how many buttons. It looked like, you know, the
complexity wins. Yes.
Yeah. It looked like the control system for you know, Houston's
Doctor Who, right?
you know, something out of science fiction, and he at the same time I had bought a simple VCR that had like three buttons on it. And he said, yours is obviously worse than mine, you know, because his has more button on it.
Right.
And that was the thing for a while. And that was, it's now the same phenomenon in cars. That I was driving a car the other day, and this is not my own car. It was a Lexus. Is it GS350? That was a hybrid. It was a bit of a strange car, but I had to spend a long time orienting myself around the systems, and nothing was really consistent. There were things on the left, things on the right, things with numbers on them, things with letters on them, things with hieroglyphics on them, and things with you know, there was a screen as well. And so there was a knob that you would rotate, and things that you push, things that you'd pull, things on the steering wheel, things on the console. It was just a complete mess, and nothing even looked consistent across the whole the whole visual space in front of you. And in that sense, it's over-serving. I think the idea of of providing buttons as a proxy for features, as a proxy for performance in this metric is clearly overserving. On the other hand, what you really would have liked is, how can I get my journey cut in half? How can you make my trip more productive? And there's no solution that's dreamed of. I think the nearest thing is, you know, the driverless car. But the real problem is congestion, in the sense that we got to actually take more cars off the road. And that if a driverless car can do that and reduce congestion, then trip times will decrease, and we'll actually feel that actually we're making progress on transportation. If you took into account traffic, transportation is actually getting worse, not better. All that horsepower is useless because we're hardly making 20 miles an hour on average. And so if you look at places like Manhattan, places, urban centers, the traffic speed through those cities is single digits on average. It's really much worse than a horse. So that's the question, you know, what do we really want out of cars? And that's the problem, I think, with the success of the category, with the proliferation of vehicles, we've actually made things worse. And that's been something that's actually been going, this problem of traffic was something that's been debated for 50 years. There were traffic jams in the 1920s, probably even earlier. And what was going on is that people said, well, the solution is to build more roads. And the road building took 50 years. And once we were done building roads, we realized that the traffic was even worse. And that was because as roads were built, more cars were bought. And the capacity of the system was at 100% as soon as it was opened, and so, or above 100%. There's a story I'm told that the Long Island Expressway, which was built to connect Long Island residency areas to Manhattan, they built the super highway in order to improve the traffic to New York. But as soon as it was open, it was a parking lot, and so it didn't help at all. In that sense, right? And this is the real challenge about transportation. Well, one thing is, when you look at alternatives, you know, you look at smaller cars. Not just Gordon Murray with his T25, which is a car that it's really narrowed and has a configuration of three seats, one in the center and then two on either side in the back, allowing you for a much narrower car. But other concepts like the Smart and others have attempted not to make cars. Or even Smart isn't the right answer, because Smart is about as wide as a normal car, but it's much shorter. What we really need is the ability to say, okay, much narrower vehicles, like maybe it's equivalent to a motorcycle, that would allow us to put two cars in the space of one lane. That would be interesting. That could change the change traffic patterns, unless people bought millions of them again.
But to address these problems in the future, because then I also read recently that Ford is setting up shop in Silicon Valley. This is kind of a Groundhog Day thing, because they've been there before. But they claim that they need to enable, you know, almost a P2P communication networks between vehicles to address some of these, you know, traffic and car sharing opportunities and all that.
Google is doing that already, because right. Everybody who has Google Maps running is essentially calling back to Google servers and telling the world where they are and how fast they're going. I think Google has pretty much perfect knowledge of, and Apple now, even so, even with its hundreds of millions of iOS devices, is managing to get a great picture of how. Where traffic is, sure. And what's, without even putting special software into the device to solve the problem. There's no traffic app you need. It's just maps. And so in that sense, that data is flowing in a sort of crowdsourced way.
Sure, it's above the industry, though, or around the industry, you'd say.
Yeah, it's exactly right. It's bypassing the people who think that they need to control that or accumulate that information. So it's It's already happening in a way, but it's very ad hoc. But probably that will become the normal way of assessing traffic. And there are privacy issues which hinder exploiting it too much, right? So the idea is that information cannot go to state government or local governments that can then say, okay, they have to rely on a separate parallel traffic monitoring solution, right? They need to put up cameras and do all these things to see patterns of traffic and therefore switch the lights on and off in a different way to alleviate or manage the problem. But here's much more granular data you could obtain from individual vehicles that should be funneled to those who can help with traffic management. But again, privacy issues would prohibit that. And so I'm not sure how that's going to get solved. But yeah, this is why would Ford solve this problem? How could Ford solve this problem?
Seems like they're 15 years too late.
Yeah, it's also not the way to do it. It's not through an automaker.
Right.
How many Fords are in the typical traffic pattern? I mean, there'll be a minority. So it's all these things added up that, you know, that the automakers are not in a position to even, I think,
even play.
Play or be part of they don't need to sit at the table. What they need to do is say, just like a mobile network operator, we need to say, you know, yes, we're BitPipe. And so an automaker needs to recognize that they too are essentially a chassis upon which a smart device rests. And that's why we, you know, I use the metaphor of saying that they're an accessory to the smartphone. As far as services and data are concerned, they just need to open up the chassis and say, okay, we are
have your way with me. Yes.
Yeah. And yeah, you can take pieces, or take sensors, from my vehicle and channel that information through the cloud. And it's your data and you do with it what you want. We're just going to provide the hardware and the sensors. By the way, I tried this automatic. This is an interesting experience as well.
All right, we've talked about that, right?
So I finally got it, and I tried it in two cars. And it is marginally useful, but it's very marginally useful. It seems to be useful for somebody who needs to learn how to be a better driver, especially if they're a very young driver or they're just a very inexperienced driver, because what it does is it gives you basic guidance on how to drive more efficiently and more smoothly. So it warns you when you accelerate too fast. It warns you when you brake too fast. It warns you when you exceed a certain speed limit. It calculates for you your fuel cost, and therefore it gives you a score of your performance. It is, of course, tailored towards having a sort of a very mild manner driving style, I should say, because it rewards this kind of non-aggressive driving. But it's still, and that's fine, which, by the way, I first tried it in my Porsche and it was a disaster. And because it just kept beeping at me all the time. I mean, of course, you're going to end up with more acceleration and more braking.
Sort of gets in the way of the turbo whine.
Well, it doesn't have the turbo.
It's aspirated. Yes,
naturally aspirated. Still plenty of power.
Yes,
but the thing was that it really wasn't the job to be done of sort of teaching someone how to drive gently is not the job of the Porsche is hired for. So then I put it in another car, and it just. Which was the wagon, but it doesn't help me either, because I kind of know exactly what to do to get that 100% score. I'm already very conscious of what fuel, what causes more fuel burn, and so in fact the best diagnostic tool I've ever seen in a car is a measurement of your gas consumption on a continuous basis. So if you put, instead of, you know, watching your speedometer, which doesn't change that much, but watch your fuel
consumption, right?
that figure is firstly, is wildly entertaining. Secondly, it actually helps you control your behavior because it's well, like
it's a financial incentive, right?
Yeah, it becomes a game, and you're also trying, you know, hey, let's see how far we can go, or how much higher we can get our MPG, or in Europe, it's liters per 100 kilometer of fuel, and so then it keeps the track of that. And this funny thing is that this app, this automatic, doesn't naturally do that. It doesn't. It doesn't, since the fuel system, I think maybe newer cars may give that detail through this ODBD, or is it ODB port, whatever it's called, the data connection.
I wonder what it has access to, because I was going to mention 2 weeks ago the Financial Times had an article where they interviewed a BMW executive who said they have a firewall in place to, quote, protect crucial information about the internal running of the car, and they will not share it with the Silicon Valley companies. And it was interesting, you know, right, exactly what we're talking about here, yeah.
Well, you know, people have hacked cars as a hobby.
There goes your warranty, right?
But, yeah, well, you know, chipping cars and so
right,
on. I don't,
right.
But I'm just saying very basic things. I mean, as far as the kind of data that seems to be finally trickling out of the car, you could get a lot richer data. In fact, another app I used is the one that measures everything about your journey in terms of using the GPS, right? Using your phone's location and somewhat the accelerometer as well, so it can measure your altitude, your position, your speed, and it doesn't do so through any interface to the car. It just does it over the air. It just uses a satellite. I mean, it has to go to space to find out what you're doing. But here's your car knowing all that, not being able to tell you at all what it's doing. That's how it's gotten you. And that app, by the way, costs $2. You know, you pay right. $2 to find out much more information than your auto, you know, the machine that you pay tens of thousands for
right.
is willing to tell you. And now the car maker supposedly is going to make sure they protect you from knowing too much. Give me a break. I mean, this is these people are from a different century.
Right. So we see that tension continuing, and we still don't see where the information dam might break. Maybe one of the manufacturers will zig where everybody else zags. Who knows?
Tesla was a hope. You know, I mean, we had this hope that Tesla could, coming in as they did from a completely different industry, with a completely different point of view. And this is something, I mean, people keep having a spirited debate, let's say, with folks on Twitter about Tesla. They send me all kinds of videos to listen to Elon Musk speak. And,
oh, boy.
And, you know, it's fine. I kind of see exactly where he's coming from. Okay, he's a very charismatic, and has an extremely charming story to tell. But the problem is that, again, I think of it as being super naive, and it's no insult to him. I think that's great. You know, he's doing these great initiatives, and I love the audacity of wanting to build a space transportation system, or wanting to build new energy infrastructure, and he did not simply make another .com. And those are good things to do. I think that the world needs more Elon Musks. But at the same time, it's not a foxy way of doing it, meaning that he doesn't act in this kind of like, he has the, because of the charm, because of charisma, because of character, he doesn't address the world as an underdog. He doesn't address the world as, and again, he'll say he's an outsider and so on. But what I'm seeing is like this kind of like, don't pay any attention to me. I'm actually, you know, self-effacing is important here. You've got to actually fly in a way that doesn't flaunt, doesn't, you know, it doesn't create obvious confrontation. You've got to be, and this is part of asymmetry, right? It's being, in a way, saying, pay no attention to what I'm doing. This is completely not relevant. And you don't say that. You just do something irrelevant. You just do something that seems irrelevant. And in so doing, you actually solve the problem. And you get, it's not only about avoiding conflict and avoiding the avoidance of symmetry is fundamental to solving the problem. It's not just fundamental to being saving yourself from being beaten up. It's really about uncovering and solving the mystery, because the asymmetry gives you the opens the door to looking at the world in truly a different way, and that means following it not just in a technically different way, but or technologically different way, but in a business model different way. And someone asked me, well, what would it mean for you to agree, or how would you characterize a Tesla that's disruptive? Because I said flat out, Tesla is not disruptive. It's just not. It's just not. And the question is, how? What would you want it to look like to say yes, it is? And I said, well, it would have to compete in a way that is completely asymmetric, and that means to me either selling cars to people who have never had cars before, and that would be. So, and I, you know, the example there is that he makes cars explicitly to sell to people who never had a car before. And that would mean to me the only markets that are still like that are probably Africa and maybe some parts of Asia. And so if he set up Tesla in, Uganda, I would say, great, there's a chance. In fact, I hope there are people in Uganda who are setting up car companies, or in Nigeria. I hope they are going there and making cars. That's one way of doing it. The other way is to sort of say, as Uber did, it's like, we don't even worry about the car. We're going to solve transportation in a completely different way. In fact, ultimately, at the end of the day, is that the answer is that there will be no cars. That the answer will be, or there will be so much fewer cars.
Pure sharing,
Car
as
like
a service.
Sharing so much, because it's more about utilizing something that is idle. So it's maximizing utilization. And it's in that process, cars don't just sit around. And then someone observed that if cars were driverless, then they could really be free agents that get hired. But that's exactly what Uber does with that, by having a human driver, which we used to call cabbies. But the idea was that, it's the asset is sitting idle. You put it to use. In so doing, you actually change transportation systems. You could probably reduce the number of cars that are on the road by 50%. You solve congestion, and you go back to this problem with what's not done. What's not done is reducing congestion. So the mission statement of Tesla could be either, one, let's sell cars to people who've never had cars before, and we'll make them cheap and adaptive to their needs, thus be disruptive in the way Toyota was disruptive, in the way Ford was disruptive in its beginning. That's the classic way, the sort of the low-end disruption. Volkswagen, same thing. Volkswagen sold Beetles to people who didn't have cars. Toyota sold initially really crappy cars to people who didn't have cars. And Ford sold cars to people who didn't have cars. They all essentially created huge chunks of the industry by their entry. And so that's plan A. Plan B is to say, look, my goal is not to compete with non-consumption. My goal is to actually destroy consumption. And in that second approach, which is also deeply asymmetric, is to say my goal is to remove as many cars from the road as possible. And so the second approach would be one to say, we don't make cars, we destroy cars. Now, who does that? It's like this first model, the low end, is possibly going to emerge. I've heard of attempts to do this in private, and I can't share them. But in the second case, it's Uber who's doing this, and to a much, much lesser degree, Google. I mean, because Google is focused on the technology, not on the solution. Uber is strictly focused on the solution and not so much on the technology.
The business model, too, obviously.
Right.
I'm glad you brought that up, because while my German is limited, I came across an article last week, I think it was in Welt, and they said that Volkswagen is dangerously close to China's Politburo. So when we think about change and market entry, and I know you're spending a good amount of time on incumbents and new products and when critical mass is reached and what happens, how much time you have. So anyway, this article in Welt said that essentially Volkswagen was forced to build a large factory in far northwest China, where there's not much there, because of, you know, the politics, and they're very close, and that Volkswagen's working very hard to balance their very large business in China and grow it elsewhere outside of China, because they're, you know, there's certain relationships, certain things that must be done as one of their spokesmen at a closed economy. So that you have that.
It is a political, you know, to be in the car business today is to be a politician. There's not much difference, right? And even Musk has to be that, because he has to, you know, get huge loan guarantees and huge subsidies and manage massive infrastructures. Like
he said, like 2 weeks ago in Texas, he might even sell through dealers, which I thought was
but he had to, you know, he wants to build a gigafactory, and he has to get concessions on it. Of course you have to be that, but that, I'm not saying that you shouldn't do ever that's part of doing business. That's the cost of doing business. But the thing is that, you know, the industry has become, that has become the primary question rather than solving any kind of problem.
Yes.
So the problem is it's die by the sword, right? It's live by the sword and die by the sword. So they live by production, and so they die by production. They everything is oriented around production. This is what I think people from outside the industry, and I have to constantly restate this because it's so non-obvious to people outside the industry. You just cannot appreciate how manufacturing or production is the core value system of the industry. Everything revolves around it, and in that sense, it's always been that way. It's always been about factories, about massive capex, about having the tooling to build things. And once you get that started, you've got to keep it going. And the pipe and the pump has to run, you know, as if you know, that's everything that counts. And, you know, all the discussions that, you know, great stories in the industry about why did Toyota succeed to enter the market is because they tweaked the production system. It's because they realized that the famous story of the production line at GM. Production line at GM, the consensus from the 1930s up until the 1980s was that you never shut down a production line. And so cars were coming off the production line, even if there was a fault, there was clearly a fault in production, like the bumper was on backward, let's say.
Sure, it's, a breaking it's not issue, true. Whatever it might be.
But you don't stop the line and say, okay, wait a minute, the bumpers are going on backwards. Take that machine offline, fix it so that it puts it on the right way, or take the guy who's doing it, take him offline and replace him with a guy who knows how to do it right. No, that would never happen. That was actually against almost like the very core laws of the universe. A production line always keeps running, and you fix things once they get done. Is you have a process of repairing the cars that have just been built. To correct that problem.
Rework.
And this is because the dogma of production lines since Henry Ford is that it's very, very expensive to stop production and start it up again. And not only is it expensive, but could be crippling. It literally, you could lose your business doing that. And so when Henry Ford built his production system, he had it so optimized that he couldn't actually switch the production to a new car model. He was stuck making Model Ts for so long.
For years, yes.
For years, and GM came with a new model, and Ford had to shut down its production system for like 6 months, its whole factories, for 6 months in order to create the next model, which also ran for like 10 years. And then, you know, they couldn't figure out a system. So what GM introduced was the ability to have a model year change so that every year you could actually retool a little bit, tweak a little bit the production line so that you come out with a new car and that doesn't put you out of business. In Henry's Ford, it would have put him out of business. So he would never do it. And then so we saw progress on this dimension until Toyota and others worked out how to do this. And all along, this has been the decision-making process. How do we make our production system? And that meant building new factories, where to place these factories, how big they should be, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that thinking remains, and that's what you're seeing with Volkswagen is like, okay, in order for us to stay in business in China, we need to build production, capacity out in the boonies, because that's what gives us points.
Right.
That gives us political points. Right. And why does it give up political points? Because the people who told him to do so know the rules of the game and said, you guys, do you know what? I don't want to get in the weeds on this, but it's so clear to me that the industry revolves around production, not product.
No, it's how they print their money. And you see that even today now, there's more and more data coming out on subprime auto lending. So again, we're back in this
exactly
game.
The financing game, the distribution game, the even this question of integration is because of the production system. You know, we go back to this initial conversation we had in the show, was that why aren't they modular? Well, they're not modular because the production system as it exists now, you have to essentially slot that in early on. You got to, you know, line up the system to ready to switch on, and when you switch it on, you got to keep it going. And so for you to do that reliably, you can't have loose ends in that sense of having, well, is that module really going to be there or not? Can we just defer decision? No, you must have the decision years in advance as to what, you know, what's in the dashboard. And so that's why you see the causal relationships go all the way back to production systems. So if you had a more flexible production system, you might actually have a shot at the redefining. So I think the next leap, as I said, there was Ford, GM, Toyota, production systems. These are all production systems. These are the major pivots in the industry. And the next, there's going to be another production system because the world does move on. And I think that, you know, it's about time that we did get that new production system. And I've been pounding the table on Gordon Murray's idea of iStream. Now, he may not be the only one, but he certainly got the right idea. And he understands it. And he's not a naive outsider. He knows the business. And although he doesn't know it as deeply as a production system might think he's learned, but I think it came from an outside point of view, as in the car industry, but from the racing side of it. And so that's the right perspective. And whether he cracks the nut or whether BMW with its i3, which I think has also an innovative production system, because they had to switch to composites, because they were forced to go away.
Far more modular than anything else they built.
It's far more modular, and that's a very big deal. Mm-hmm. I saw a video of a company which does reverse engineering.
Yeah, the teardown. Yeah. We talked about that. Yeah,
reverse engineering in i3, and the idea was that wow, these guys actually can take parts of the power system, which is electric, and fix it in the field. Whereas up and prior to that point, you know, a fault in a cell in the middle of a power pack would force a manufacturer to go to the dealer.
And I'm glad you sort of segued to that, because there's another bit of data that came out just recently. Another well-connected multi-billionaire, George Soros, apparently has one of his funds wining and dining with large U.S. car dealers. So following Buffett, there's somebody who's very connected politically, has lots of interest,
actually,
and he's buying
Buffett,
car dealers.
I think the thing that Buffett did, I think that's probably the only disruptive thing I've ever seen Buffett do, is go to China to say, I'm going to invest in a Chinese car company, which is positioned around batteries, but it's still, that is that low-end story I've been telling you about.
Right.
Now, do they have the incentives to go to non-consumption, or is China big enough as a non-consumption area? That we'll have to see. By the way, it would really help us to understand the Chinese auto market, because it is the largest in terms of production by far.
17 million now,
Way, way above the United States, way above Japan. That's only happened in the last 6 years or so. I'd say less than 10 years. That they've gone from very low production to absolutely staggering production. Second thing is that there's a huge number of brands. There's a huge number of companies making cars now. There's some who are probably, you know, almost illegal and they're not certified. There are electric cars and unregistered types of vehicles. There's electric scooter models. There's all kinds of innovations in that sense, or experiments going on in China with respect to transportation. And a lot of that also is coupled to road building, to public transport, to massive, massive infrastructure. China went from being, you know, medieval to being, you know, like almost, I would say, Western standards in terms of its urban infrastructure within a number of decades. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Sure. Massive infrastructure.
It is the biggest development story ever. But in so doing, there are things they completely carbon copied. And I think this is what's interesting is when you're going that fast, if you're saying we want to have an auto industry in 10 years, you don't set about it doing it like Elon Musk did. They said, let's figure this out on our own. Let's try an experiment here and there. Or you don't do it like Silicon Valley did and say, okay, just, you know, here's some venture money, fund 1,000 startups to figure this out. No, you have a blueprint already. We want a car industry. There's about a dozen out there that we can copy. There are about a dozen car industry participants as far as states are concerned, nations. So these are countries we can copy. Just stepping back a little bit on the side, same thing happened with shipbuilding. This is very interesting. Yes. If you go back and look at the
states, England, massive state sponsors.
There were two countries in the world, probably at the turn of the 19th century, right? We're talking 1800, who had the capability of making large scale navies, and that was France and England. And they had a war, and England won. That was the Napoleonic Wars. And so Britain, for the rest of the 19th century, was probably the only country in the world that had a global reach with its navy. And as a result, they built an empire. And so there's the British Navy. The British Army was never amounting to anything, right? Even during the Napoleonic Wars, they were tiny compared to the French or Germans, or even, you know, some of the secondary countries like Spain. But yet, as far as navies were concerned...
Sure, they had a blue water fleet, yeah.
England ruled the waves. Mm-hmm. This is not just a nice saying. It is actually true. Britannia rules the waves. So what happened then? Well, by the late part of the 20th century, a lot of countries were prospering and were wanting to join the league of empire. You know, they wanted to be empires, and they wanted to be, therefore, they reasoned logically that, look, to have an empire, we need a navy. And so everybody needed a navy, and so they turned to England as a source of knowledge, and sort of there's the blueprint for being a naval power. So the Americans did, the Japanese, even the Russians. These are newcomers into the game, and they all essentially actually commissioned shipbuilding from not so much the United States, but like even countries like Argentina, Brazil. You hear when you read about military ships, the number that were built in England and actually sold to countries around the world. So the shipyards in England, after fulfilling orders for the Royal Navy, they started to fulfill orders for other navies. And so it was, and also, how do you train your officers? Where you go to England and you put them in naval academies, and you learn how to manage these ships, and you learn about tactics, and you know, learn about gunnery, and you learn all of the, in fact, the Japanese Navy was 100% patterned after the Royal Navy. And the Japanese Navy, we're talking about 1900 or so. And so they got themselves a navy within about 20 years. And the navy that they got was good enough to beat Russia, which was a huge empire relative to Japan. It was the first time an Asian country beat a European power in naval warfare. And that was the Battle of Tsushima, which was the Russo-Japanese War, which they won, which caused Japan to feel so self-confident that 40 years later they went to war with the United States. That was amazing. And the whole
genesis.
Thing,
mm-hmm.
The genesis of it is that they said, well, Navy is the way to be, especially as an island nation, a naval presence. And so the Navy became so powerful, by the way, this is yet another aside to the aside, is that the Navy was big enough.
Ran
the country and sort of outvote they could outvote
We could talk for a long time on that. But I want to circle back just a little bit.
Let me finish. Because I kind of went. Let me just wrap back up. So okay. What happened is, because 100 years ago, that meant if you wanted a navy, you copied best practices, and that was the Royal Navy. If in late 20th century you wanted an industrial base, you copied the United States in terms of its industrial base, and that meant, or perhaps a bit of Europe as well, sure. But it meant at the time copying production systems. And, mm-hmm. and so the Chinese essentially picked up what they could from Japan, from the United States, from Europe, and said, okay, now those are the blueprints for having a car production and economy. And you cannot do it with an ad hoc, let's just figure it out on our own and maybe do it better. Let's do it in a way that's sensitive to our indigenous needs. No, they went ahead and carbon copied. Now, as a result, though, they end up with no real innovation in terms of really solving these problems that we talked about at the beginning. Had they really gone through a much more, I would say, innovative approach and then slower approach, right?
But sure, more petri dish as opposed to command.
They could have. I think at the end of the day, right now, we're not seeing China threatening global dominance in terms of car production, but if they were really asymmetric, they might have come up with the way Japan did with a really different kind of car, which is much more reliable,
which was the
main thing back in the 80s.
So the last thing I wanted to bring up quickly and just seeing the seeds of change, you know, we talked about Uber and then we talked briefly about Volkswagen in China, which led to this, but I read recently that Uber, as part of their deal with the politics of these cities, is beginning to offer trip data to the cities and hopefully
Boston
publicly.
Is one of them, yeah.
Exactly, Boston. And so to me, it sort of begins to lay the groundwork for yet another tax regime, probably, based on that trip data.
You're so cynical.
Well, but it's true, you know, because look at everything that's around, all the finances that are around our current car-based system. I mean, you have insurance, you know, it's required in most states. You have tolls, you have all the gas taxes, all these things that have been in place now for decades. And
there are ways. What's going to be really taking away from the state budgets and the coffers are the reduced consumption. So
right,
that's going
right.
to happen.
But the trip cost is the next vector.
Yeah. So I'm not. Yeah. You know, I don't think that these organizations that are now addicted to the cash coming from the auto industry or from the transportation sector are really going to be able to manage. If it's truly asymmetric, they're going to be completely blindsided because.
Well, it's going to be a fraction of the money. Absolutely.
Yeah. So the pain, this kind of unintended consequences, you know, it's the same thing with the way Russia has mishandled everything. And then sort of they think they're being clever, but in fact, they're just completely being stupid. And so this notion of well, let's anticipate things, let's plan, let's tax. It can really backfire in completely unintended ways, and I don't know how to read this except to say that it's unlikely that bureaucrats could really anticipate how the game is going to change.
Correct, I completely agree. And but you know, Oregon, I believe, has already floated GPS in the cars and taxing your trips, and again. Is that all going to play out? I don't know. The one of the executives at Ford last year talked about their data collection and their sharing, and then he had a backtrack. And so one could imagine, much like the cell companies and the other industries where, you know, deals are made and money flows. And so it's interesting to watch the change.
I think the biggest thing that's happening is this idea that young people stop driving.
Right.
It's the most destructive thing because – It really, once you push people and you keep adding taxes, you keep adding tolls,
sure,
you keep
burden.
Adding yeah. friction to the transportation equation, and people just opt out.
Yes.
Speaking of, you know, here's another anecdote. It's like you refer to your acquaintances, people you know who don't care about driving.
Yeah,
I have my own.
The son still is not driving, by the way.
I have a nephew who says, you know, I went to his graduation. And I said, so what are you thinking about getting a car?
Buy a car.
No, he's not thinking about a car. He's graduated. He's going to have a job. He's going to have money, but he's not going to buy a car.
Right.
He thinks the last thing on his list is a car. He'd rather, you know, have the iPad, the iPhone,
travel, whatever,
Mac, the travel, the everything else,
right.
but a car. And I was watching another. That's one. The other one is Top Gear. Top Gear has, you know, this this segment where they have a star in a reasonably priced car, and to be, you know, hip with the younger crowd, they're inviting younger people to be on the show. Some of these people I've never heard of, but they're, you know, pop stars or actors. And increasingly, they're getting people who don't know how to drive.
Right, right.
This is the last show actually came out last week. It had a young man. I don't know his name. He was very charming, nice young man. But he not only didn't have a driver's license, he had never driven before, like ever been in front of a steering wheel in his life.
Right.
So, you know, he went on the track to do a lap, and that was the first time he'd driven. And he was already a superstar and, you know, famous and rich. And so this is why it's increasingly the case that young people opt out. And that's really the most
disruptive,
the most damning thing you can imagine.
Yeah, I think that's ignore it. Yeah, it's ignored.
and so demand is going to collapse.
Yes.
If they continue to make it hard, and only us old geezers, you know, are going to be
paying, paying and driving. That's right. All right. Well, with that, it's always a pleasure, Horace. Thanks for a good show.
Thanks a lot.